The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack from the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. If you'd like to talk to them, they can be reached at 919-781-1973. We're going to be reading from the January 2018 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. We've been talking about the best of winter, and last week we read all about the season for soups. That was the entire issue. Most of today's reading will be from this section called 1940s, the Decade of Transformation. It's one article. Our State's look at the people and events that shaped the 40s continues with the start of World War II. And the article title is The Liberty Armada. When America went to war in 1941, the Navy turned to Wilmington to provide ships. The city's response helped secure victory for the Allies and left a lasting mark on the North Carolina coast. Written by Philip Girard. He was the one who did that very, very lengthy series on the Civil War that we read last year. As the decade turns from the calamitous 1930s, with its stock market crash and bank failures, its dust bowl and depression, its unemployment and hunger, to the restless 1940s, war appears more and more inevitable. The Whiteville News Reporter offers its readers New Year's greetings, Peace on Earth, 1940. But days later announces national defense expansion urged by the president. In November 1941, the Wilmington Morning Star reports, U.S. warship torpedoed while on convoy patrol in the North Atlantic. 77 men of the Reuben James, including 7 officers, remain missing and are feared dead. The story resonates with locals. The skipper, Lieutenant Commander H.L. Edwards, had married a Wilmington girl just 6 months prior. Later that same month, the tanker Salinas is torpedoed by a U-boat. America is a continental island. To go to war means crossing an ocean, Atlantic or Pacific, and that requires ships. From colonial times through Civil War and the Great War, the Cape Fear River has been the site of shipyards. But no new ship has been built here since 1918. Now the North Carolina Shipbuilding Company, a subsidiary of the Newport News Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Company, sets up on the east bank of the Cape Fear. Wilmington has won its first wartime battle against rival Morehead City, which has been actively lobbying to be the shipyard site. Newport News Shipbuilding is renowned for the craftsmanship and teamwork of its shipwrights, and the company has never endured a strike in half a century of operation. But the company is also anti-union, and almost from the start of operations, the Wilmington site is locked in an ongoing dispute with the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or CIO. The president of Newport News Shipbuilding is Homer Lenore Ferguson, a Waynesboro native, the son of a Confederate veteran. His strict Scotch-Irish upbringing instilled in him a fierce work ethic and an abiding respect for those who work with their hands, including blacks. He routinely hires black workers for skilled positions such as machinist, riveter, engineer, and welder. He was elevated to lead the company after his predecessor, A.L. Hopkins, went down on the torpedoed Lusitania in the Great War. Ferguson is 68 years old, a U.S. Naval Academy graduate who studied naval architecture in Glasgow, Scotland, the nation that produced revolutionary fast blockade runners for the Confederates during the Civil War. The plan for the Cape Fear shipyard is straightforward and efficient. Construct 37 new cargo ships at a cost of $42 million to a uniform design adopted from the British and used by all American shipyards, which can be modified for tankers and fitted with anti-aircraft guns, and carry supplies to England through the Lend-Lease Act of 1941. Rather than use the traditional expensive and time-consuming method of riveting steel plates, workers will build the ships in modules and weld the pieces together, a technique that has not been tried much in ocean-going vessels. No one really expects the ships to hold up for more than a few years, but speed and efficiency are worth the risk. The company harnessed federal subsidies to create three housing projects for some 900 workers. Greenville Terrace, of permanent construction, houses 300 white families with rent starting at $27.50 per month. Lake Village, of demountable temporary fabrication, houses another 475 white families. The 126 black families find homes in Hillcrest Extension, a permanent community with rents of $18 to $22. The two white communities are located near Greenville Lake, just north of the shipyard, and an easy commute away. Housing for black workers is located at Dawson and 14th and 15th Streets, several miles away. Buses serve all three communities. Some of the fleet of 140 trucks and buses ferrying workers back and forth between Wilmington and the beach towns, and also places as far away as Whiteville, Fairmont, Lumberton, and St. Paul's. When the whistle blows, signaling the end of a shift, workers sprint from the gates for more than a block to secure a seat on the homebound bus, or else be forced to stand as strap hangers. Work gangs are integrated, with white and black men working alongside one another in a range of skilled and unskilled jobs, but dining, restroom, and locker facilities are strictly segregated. White workers read the shipyard bulletin. Their black counterparts enjoy the colored shipbuilder. Discrimination by Maritime Commission contractors is prohibited by executive order, but practice does not always follow the law. During periods of racial tension, blacks and whites exit the yard through separate gates. In a matter of months, the shipyard takes shape on almost 57 riverside acres, including its own bus terminal, cafeteria, police and fire departments, and even a hospital. 400 Newport News employees are transferred down from Virginia, but more than 500 men and women are recruited locally, plumbers, carpenters, and electricians, along with unskilled trainees who will have to learn on the job. At first, women are relegated to less strenuous jobs, but they quickly prove their abilities and take on more physically demanding jobs, such as plumbing and welding. They dress in slacks and blouses and find work shoes where they can, a difficult task since steel-toe boots are manufactured only in men's sizes. Many wear Boy Scout shoes or regular open-toe footwear, and broken toes are a constant hazard. The yard is swarming with workers 24 hours a day in three shifts, but women are allowed to work only the first two, never the graveyard shift, and never below decks of a vessel, to avoid compromising situations. The company provides on-site daycare for their young children, though young women without children are most valued as workers. At night, the yard is illuminated by nearly 2,000 floodlights, with an unintended, dangerous consequence. Captains of vessels passing off Cape Fear complain that on a cloudy night, with no moon, they are silhouetted against the bright loom of the yard, making them perfect targets for U-boats. On the night of March 12, 1942, the tanker John D. Gill, bound for Philadelphia, is torpedoed and sunk near the mouth of the river. Future sea trials for new commissioned vessels are conducted entirely inside the river. The yard keeps growing, eventually housing a shop for a new high-speed turbine gear so secret that the shop is left off maps of the site. Within 2 years, the shipyard employs 25,000 people and dispenses a payroll of $50 million a year, transforming Wilmington into a lively boom town as young workers with money to spend mingle with soldiers, sailors, and Marines at the growing collection of USOs, bars, and nightclubs. The USO on 2nd and Orange opens 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it becomes one such social hub. Junior hostess at Liberty Bell's dances with servicemen, mend their uniforms, and serve them refreshments. Before it launches a single vessel, the shipyard is clouded by controversy. The first of the designated Liberty ships scheduled to come off the ways in December will be named Francis Marion, honoring the Revolutionary War guerrilla leader from South Carolina. Others are to be named for Nathaniel Greene and Daniel Morgan, Revolutionary War generals from Rhode Island and New Jersey, respectively, and four more South Carolinians, John C. Calhoun, Charles C. Pinckney, William Moultrie, and Edward Rutledge. The naming choice strikes a blow to local pride. The Star reports, without a byline, that the Wilmington Chamber of Commerce is protesting to Admiral Emery S. Land, chair of the United States Maritime Commission. Thus, it would appear that to date, South Carolina has gained more recognition than any state in the number of vessels constructed here. Just weeks before the launch, the commission accedes to the protest. The new vessel, instead, will be christened Zebulon B. Vance after the lionized Civil War governor of North Carolina. The ship will stretch 441 feet and 6 inches in length with a beam of 56 feet, displacing 14,100 tons and drafting 27 feet and 8 inches. The Vance will be manned by 44 officers and crew and will carry more than 9,000 tons of cargo, 440 tanks, 2,840 jeeps, or 230 million rounds of small arms ammunition. The price tag is steep, $1.6 million. It will become a cog in the great wheel of defense, the Star reports, the Vance and hundreds of its sister ships being built at yards on every coast of this nation will make up the great commercial armada in history. The Greater Wilmington Chamber of Commerce sponsors a laudatory congratulations under the headline, "There She Goes! Bon voyage to you, O good ship Zebulon B. Vance! Wilmington made, you have aboard a full cargo of Wilmington pride. May good fortune always attend you as you carry the stars and stripes of a free country through the troubled waters of the world." The Vance will be loaded immediately and after being fitted out and will carry the Wilmington port's first lend-lease cargo. The launch takes place at noon on December 6. Newport News Company's Ferguson presides, opening the short ceremony with brief remarks, followed by Captain Edmund McCauley of the U.S. Maritime Commission. Governor Joseph Melville Broughton also addresses the crowd. The winner of the largest vote in history, honoring the legacy of another wartime governor who won by a landslide. His wife, Alice Wilson Broughton, christens the ship with a traditional bottle of champagne. The Vance is the first of 243 ships to be built at Wilmington. Of both Liberty and the Faster Victory design, 27 of which will be sunk by the enemy. But the Vance is lucky. On the dreaded Murmansk run, it survives a torpedo attack and floating mines, then serves in the transport fleet for the invasion of North Africa. Later, it does duty as a hospital ship, renamed USS John J. Meany. Its final tour in the war is to transport war brides from Europe. But all of that lies in the turbulent future. As spectators mob the riverbanks, the Vance, its rigging festooned stem to stern with nautical flags, slides stern first down the ways and plunges into the river, sending a tan and brown wave surging toward the far bank. A squadron of tugboats blast their whistles and quickly nudge the great vessel alongside the fitting-out dock. The dignitaries retire to a celebratory luncheon at the Cape Fear Country Club. Workers like Elverton Shands, who was trained as a tank tester at Newport News before returning to the shipyard for the launching of the Vance, heads for home. Scarcely 24 hours later, Shands is upstairs listening to the radio. It was the Washington Redskins and the Bears game, he recalls. A newscaster interrupts the game to report the Japanese forces have attacked Pearl Harbor. Well, I knew my father was in the Navy, and I came downstairs and I said, "Daddy, where is Pearl Harbor?" His father tells him. Now the Liberty Armada will be sailing into a world war. The ships launched on the Cape Fear are considered among the best and most efficiently built vessels of their time. But on April 16, 1946, the last ship slides down the ways, the SS Santa Isabel. The North Carolina Shipbuilding Company shutters its operation and releases most of its 25,000 workers. After 5 years of active politicking and negotiation by the state's congressional delegation and other proponents, on November 15, 1949, the state's Ports Authority is granted a 50-year lease on the northeast section of the yard, the beginning of a true modern port. Part of the site will be developed into the Port of Wilmington, a modern state deepwater port planned but never realized after World War I. The Liberty ships at last retire from the high seas, but the port they made possible remains. Coming next month, the soundtrack of the decade is as diverse as the musicians creating it. I'm not sure what that refers to, but that's what it says. And we have a sidebar here, celebrating Wilmington's role in World War II. A wartime youngster, Wilbur Jones, will remember the constant activities surrounding shipbuilding in his hometown of Wilmington, particularly the social events taking place just as constantly at the Orange Street USO. The building has been preserved as a community arts center, as well as a public museum featuring furniture and signage, plus the original floor and piano, pictured above with Jones, that Hannah Block, for whom the building is named, played when she worked at the USO. A retired U.S. Navy Reserve captain and historian, Jones began a quest in 2007 to have Wilmington named America's World War II city. He was motivated not only by the city's contributions during the war years, but also because Wilmington continues to identify, preserve, and interpret the rich legacy of World War II at historic sites, including the Cape Fear Museum, Shipyard Market, Bergwin Wright House, and the most visible symbol in the city, the steel-gray, flag-fluttering, floating behemoth known as the Battleship North Carolina. Jones has been persistent in his pursuit of a bill that would grant the historic designation, but legislation has stalled. Happily, 2018 is looking better for Jones's dream. Hannah Block Historical USO Building is at 120 South 2nd Street in Wilmington. And you are listening to Our State Magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. If you have any comments on our show, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Well, from Wilmington to Tarboro, it's a bit northwest. And this is under the We Live Here series. Spend just one day at the heart of this historic town, and you'll understand how, for more than three centuries, it's been able to preserve its charm. Tarboro is a walking town, a front porch sitting place, a kind of community where "tell your mama I said hey" is yelled from car windows. And no wonder. Established in 1760, it's had time to be worn in and loved well. Here, neighbors share a rich history of wars and floods, renewal and preservation. From Calvary Episcopal Church, consecrated in 1868, to the carefully restored homes and architecture in its 45-block historic district, one of the largest in the state, Tarboro embodies the spirit of its past, but isn't stuck there. There's a youthful energy on charming downtown streets, too, and the people, the murals, and shops. So go on, take a walk. There's some pictures here. It says, Tarboro Coffee House offers a warm Main Street welcome in the historic 1907 Bridgers Building, once the offices of East Carolina Railroad founder Henry Clark Bridgers. And there's three happy women laughing at some little joke in front of the window, sipping their coffee. Then we've got Calvary Episcopal Church. Inside the Gothic Revival Church are original pews and other furnishings, including an altar believed to have been made out of leftover oak used in the construction of the Confederate war ram, the CSS Albemarle. William Millennium Academy, or rather Martin Millennium Academy, says flags of many nations line the entry of Edgecombe County's first global K-8 school with Spanish immersion. Here, with help from 17 international teachers, Tarboro natives become scholars of the world. And then in the center of a series of four pictures, it says, Downtown is a family affair for Inez Ribostello, who, with her husband Stephen, owns Tarboro Brewing on the Square Restaurant. And they recommend that you try the pimento cheeseburger. Blocks away, her dad, Rusty, and stepmom, Mary Ann, sell family recipe peanut brittle at Rusty's gift shop. And now, as we continue on the We Live Here theme, the Goat Lady's Legacy. North Carolina's godmother of goat cheese left behind a lasting Piedmont landmark. Article written by Brian Mims. The woman clearly wasn't from around here. Her howdy y'all salutations were an endearing attempt at speaking Southern and breaking the ice, bless her heart. She'll drive through the rolling woodlands and farms south of Climax, exploring the two-lane, and that striking up conversations with fellas at filling stations and inquiring about land for sale. Her name was Virginia Sue Ginny Tate, and many of the locals thought she seemed odd. Here was a woman in her mid-40s with no husband, whose only kids were the kind that bleated and had hooves. Why, her two Nubian goats often rode shotgun with her. Now she wanted to run her own farm all by herself. Strange. It was 1984, and Ginny was working as a nursing administrator at Moses Cohn Hospital in Greensboro. She'd grown up on a farm in central Illinois, and she longed to sweat the dirty details of farm life again. So when she found an abandoned 40-acre tobacco farm along Jess Hackett Road with a grand old two-story house and outbuildings, she fell in love with the place. Before long, her two goats became 20. As a hobby, she made cheese out of the excess milk they produced. Raising all those kids, Ginny made a name for herself in the community, and folks began calling her the Goat Lady. In 1995, her brother Steve and his wife, Lee, moved from Illinois to help her start a full-fledged dairy goat farm, one of the first licensed in North Carolina. After tossing around ideas for a name, they settled on the most natural fit of all, Goat Lady Dairy. Some neighbors up the road, Bobby and Carrie Brads, along with Carrie's father, Tommy Ruth, joined the operation. They constructed a goat barn, a creamery, a kitchen, and a multi-purpose dining hall built of beautiful pine, oak, poplar, and cedar harvested from the property. In 2012, they expanded the creamery so that the building was nearly 10,000 square feet and moved all the goats to a farm 25 miles east in Snow Camp. Ginny Tate died in 2009 after battling ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. A few years later, Stephen and Lee Tate decided to retire, and in May 2017 sold the farm to their longtime employees, the Brads. My grandparents were tobacco farmers, Carrie says. I've always loved the country. Country life is a great life. It's a hard life, but it's a great life. The Brads are only in their 40s, but with nearly 10 grandchildren, they were thinking of the future. We didn't buy the farm for our children, we bought it for our grandkids, Carrie said. It'd be quite a legacy to leave them. Today, Goat Lady Cheese is sold from the Carolinas to California. earning accolades from the North Carolina State Fair and multiple awards from the American Cheese Society. In 2017, the Brads milked 350 goats. This year, they plan to milk 500. You can stop by the farm just about any time to buy some cheese. Just call to make sure somebody's around. Among the cheese offerings, fig and honey, roasted red pepper, Lindale, made with raw cow's milk, and Providence, a harder textured cheese that's good with olives and meats. But Goat Lady Dairy has earned renown beyond the cheese, too. On one weekend each month in the spring and the fall, the farm hosts dinner at the dairy and an often sold-out five-course dinner prepared with meat and veggies from nearby farms. Guests are treated to hors d'oeuvres on the porch, a complimentary glass of local wine, and chocolate goat cheese truffles for dessert. The couple works with three other farms in the area, raising cows and pigs as well as their goats. Carrie and Bobby were reared among these red dirt hills. Now they're reaping their livelihood and joy from this land, thanks to a woman who wasn't from around here, who kept all those goats. You know, the Goat Lady. That was written by Brian Mims, who's a reporter at WRAL. Goat Lady Farm, Jess Hackett Road, Climax, North Carolina, pretty much in the center of the state, a little bit north. The dinner at the dairy is held monthly in the spring and the fall. The tickets are $70. We're going to end with the three photos at the beginning of our state, the mini pictorial. This is North Carolina, the western picture, Beach Mountain Resort. The town of Beach Mountain in Avery and Watoga counties has a year-round population of less than 350. But for the past 50 winters, it has come alive with the skiers who flock to its snowy slopes. Ever since Beach Mountain Resort opened in 1967, the mountain's peak elevation has been a point of pride. At 5,506 feet, it's the highest ski area in the East. Today, you can ride the chairlift to the 5506 Sky Bar for drinks and snacks. Just be prepared to descend by snowboard or skis. Beautiful night picture of the slopes lit up here and there, and then the darkness of the trees in between and a purple sky. In central North Carolina, Hanging Rock State Park. Many hands pitched in to make Hanging Rock State Park a welcoming place to hike, picnic, and fish in Stokes County. Between 1935 and 1942, the 243 young men of Civilian Conservation Corps Camp 3422 shaped the natural beauty of Soratown Mountains. Picture of a tree here, right dead center on the top of some boulders. And finally, in the eastern, Swan Island. As evening falls in Knott's Island Bay in the northeast corner of the state, the remnants of a live oak are silhouetted against the sunset. Beyond Knott's Island, visible on the horizon, is Currituck Sound, an important stopover for ducks, geese, and swans migrating. Beautiful picture. The wood is dark. The sky is light blue and purple. Picture perfect. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's reading of our state magazine, and I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll join us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of our state magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at the studios, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.